Introduction. My picture-perfect summer. So, first summer. Once you get past this prologue and into the essays that follow, you may be thinking, what's with that title? Yes, many of the essays were written during what is technically summer. Most if you prefer the equinox boundary, but only a few if you prefer Labor Day. Summer is, then, a stretch for the seasonal context. Well, I had two reasons for the title. One is simply semantic. This was my first summer in Olympia, Washington, and in the new life my arrival here inaugurated. I retired at the end of May. 9 days later, having sold my house, a few pieces of furniture and my table saw, given away my car, the rest of my furniture, and most of my other belongings, I bought a first-class airline ticket for Portland, ordered up an executive limo to whisk me to the airport, packed up a carry-on suitcase, and flew off into the sunset. I mean, literally, the sun was setting when I landed in Portland. I did keep all of the artwork my kids, both visual artists and now art teachers, sent packing back home from college every summer, boxes of artifacts ticketed by them for garage storage or the garbage. But by me, destined to festoon all the walls and shelves in my house, after I built the frames or stands or whatever they required for the presentation. I lived in company with all of that beauty for years, my house like a grand two-story gallery of priceless creations made by the only two people left, most likely, who truly love me. What could be better than that? I paid a storage locker company to haul them out here, along with a few pieces of furniture I either built by myself or together with my son. Things I loved because our hands touched them in the making. Like artworks of a sort, I guess. And I threw in some clothes and kitchen supplies, enough to keep me afloat until I could get to Target or Kohl's. On the drive up from Portland to Olympia with my daughter and son-in-law, the main reasons I picked this place to start over instead of just throwing a dart at a map on the wall. We passed a truck of the company I had hired, most likely the one carrying my stuff. Kismet. I spent the first night at my daughter's house. The next day, I went to a consignment used furniture store downtown, nice things, and bought a couch, dining room table and chairs, desk and chair, various end tables, etc. It took all of 20 minutes, which were delivered the next day to the house I had rented, almost sight unseen, in advance of my arrival. A place that has turned out to be perfect for me. Way more perfect than I could have hoped for. What it's like, how it feels, where it's located. Perfect. And then the storage container with my stuff arrived. That night, I slept in a fully furnished, very comfortable home. I adorned it with art the next day. I am by nature determined and orderly when it comes to my personal spaces. I like feeling at home in them, fast. I never understood how or why anyone would inhabit a new place for weeks or months with stuff still in boxes, furniture missing or disarranged. It takes so little time and effort to put all of those things where you want them, which is what I did. By Wednesday of that week, 3 days in, I was here, all of me. And by then, I knew it was for good, too. I had initially planned to spend the summer in the vicinity of my daughter, who moved out here 12 years prior and whom I hadn't gotten to see much in the meantime. I would enjoy her company for a while until I had a clearer idea of what might be next. Well, what was next was already here, and I was living in it. I knew that for sure, that fast. Kismet. So that's the first summer in my title. The second is indexed by the comma. It's one thing to move in, to start eating and sleeping and walking in a new place. It's another thing altogether to be there, especially when everything is so different. The natural setting, the local culture, the people, the size of the place, everything except, you might say, the language. Move to a foreign country without having mastered the language ahead of time, yes, that's exponentially more difficult. But for someone like me, most lately primarily a writer of place by trade, Pretty much all of the words I knew to make sense of my world became instantly dysfunctional. I would walk down the street among flora and people and vistas I had no names for, or into the woods or by waters that bore almost no relationship by size or shape or kind to the woods and waters I knew back east. The places I'd spent a lifetime walking in and around, describing, and most especially seeing. Those circuits that connected vision with words so intimately, now suddenly broken. Such circuits are arbitrary, believe me, crafted over time like any made thing which you come to know quickly when you move this far, this fast. For good, I mean. Not as a tourist. For good. My native dialect just didn't work here. I was dumbstruck. When I tried to describe what I was seeing, there were just no words for it. Yes, of course, I was able to pen a touristy-sounding sentence or two to send back to people who knew me. But it was just that. Packaged. Generic. The surfaces. Something that sounded right. But not what my eyes were trying their best to see. Tongue-tied like that, yet still wanting to catalog my walks in the woods in some way, I started taking pictures. I'm not typically a picture taker of anything. It just never interested me, images like that. Okay, maybe I'd take a picture here and there to share with others, but they were never for me, and I never revisited them in whatever repositories they ended up in. My wife Carol was exactly the same way, but even more so. She hated to have her picture taken, or to look at pictures. About 2 years before she passed away, she brought out the box of photos we had taken of and with the kids when they were very young, under four, say, mostly to share with remote family, who were interested in them. There were hundreds of them. Interestingly, about 80% of them were of our daughter, born 4 years before our son. Bridget loved having her picture taken. Joe could have cared less. And by the time he arrived, we were picture-taking burned out in any case. We sifted through them to find the ones we thought might be most essential for them to find after we were gone, to have a visual record of their personal histories, so crucial in our current culture. And we threw out the rest. I mean, piles of photos. Gone. That may sound ghastly to you, but not to us. Made perfect sense. I have the kept photos in a book with plastic sleeves in a drawer in my living room, where they will be found when the time is right. This aversion of Carol's to picture-taking I've always attributed to her reclusivity. She hated in general to be the center of attention, to be looked at focally, as I did when I was a kid. Still do, less visibly to others, having worked hard to learn to hide it. So I understood that, and tried to respect it when picture-taking time came around. But I'm thinking now, in reaction to a comment my friend Yan Pu made in an email to me, there must be more to it than that. If not pertaining to Carol, then to me. Why, it was always words I preferred for recording and reporting what I saw, and not the camera lens, far more accurate and reliable in that regard. And I want to figure some of it out as a way of explaining, up front here, if only to myself, my mostly silent but image-saturated first summer here. I'm pretty sure it has something to do with what I called in this fall loving eyes, what such eyes make of what they see. Here's what the poet Hilda Doolittle says about Jesus in that regard. The Galilean fell in love with things as well as people. He would fall in love with a seagull or some lake heron that would dart up from the coarse lake grass when Peter leapt out to drag his great boat on shore, or the plain little speckled backs of the birds bought in the market by the poor Jews. Falling in love with things as well as people. Yes, I'll start with people, because it's easier to see love with a person at its focal point. Here are two lines from a poem in my Lee Poem series. I never remember exactly the face of someone I love. Only later, a trace. One of the things I know about myself, my deep emotional life, as it pertains to love, true love, is that when I'm in love with someone, could be filial or romantic, I can never form a clear facial image of the other in my imagination. It's always vague, soft at the edges, in motion. When I fall out of love, as happens from time to time, either because of circumstances or my own work to free myself from dysfunction, say, the face appears clear, hard and static, and it's fixed at the last point, time-wise, of my active love. This pertains to what I'm thinking about in this way. To take a photo of a loved one or to gaze at a photo of a loved one is to fix that image in time, then or now, no matter. It's the fixity, the doneness of it, that is unsettling to me. If I'm still in love with that person, there is an innate resistance that arises, as if staring at that image for too long might wear away at, corrupt, the underlying love. I would be more concerned about how strange this sounds were it not for the cliché from Native American culture about a photo stealing a piece of the subject's soul, thus producing an aversion to such capture that has nothing to do with reclusivity. That's a pretty good way of coding what I'm talking about here. I do, of course, have photographic images of Carol. She was a beautiful woman, and that shines through even when she's trying to hide herself from the lens. They're arranged now in a frame collage in the back of my sunroom, the farthest corner of my house, and I display very little else that reminds me expressly of her. Someone visiting might think, what a creep, keeping her hidden in this way, so out of the way you have to look hard to find her. There is, of course, a part of this spatial setup that is simply emotional. It makes me terribly sad to see her image and know she will never be present again. Presence, that magical force we are endowed with while we're here, quite often underestimating, even wasting its potential powers by our inattention to others, our culturally induced carelessness. So I tend to look at that collage almost out of the corner of my eye, and never for long, a way of honoring both her absence and her former presence simultaneously, of noting her stillness while keeping her in motion. And now I'm thinking about this other thing at work, the fear that too long a gaze, without any prospect for the refreshment of presence, might lock that image in my head, make me less in love with her somehow. After I moved here, I started, right off the bat, dreaming about Carol much more vividly and in more normal everyday circumstances than I had been during my last years in Pittsburgh. Always the same dreams there. She perpetually silent, grayscale, a tense despair in the air, like absolute loss was imminent, a kind of noir effect. Here, she suddenly appeared in color, said things, did things with me, quotidian things, intimate things. It was all so surprising and enjoyable. Nothing static. I took that as a good sign, that, in part, my locked-in-place grief stuttering over and over through stock-still images was releasing. And in part, that my in-loveness was still intact, in motion. Carol's first husband died very young and quite tragically. I knew him, which was how I met her. For all the time we were together, he was with us in one way or another. When we first got married, my hope was she would get over him, that I would someday be the sole focus of her in-loveness. I realized after a time that that would never happen. She told me quite often that, at least for her, it was once in love, always in love. Not in a bad way, a way that diminished new love, just that, in the terms I'm using now, the inner images of previous lovers never came to a full stop. I was not, for most of my life, like that in relation to past loves. My ambition always being to clear the space for what might be next, a process that usually took me some years and was never perfect. The sign for me that I was ready to move on was, as I said, the static image of that face in my mind's eye. Yes, I'd say. So that's done. Let's move on. I see now not only what Carol meant, but also the deeper wisdom of her way of loving. Love is so rare in this life, this world. I mean all kinds of love. To proffer it, to receive it, and even better, to have both of those states coincide, the ultimate rarity. It's not something to get over just because it stops. It is something to cherish, hold in the heart for as long as possible, forever even, no matter how complicated it makes subsequent relationships. There is a richness and density that comes with time, with age, in intimate matters of this sort, one that is enhanced, not diminished, by all the loves that came before. Some of those souls survive in the mind's eye and thereby make that mind more alive, more lovable, in the sense that all of those other presences come along for free. They might be parents, children, other lovers, all remembered and valued, there, in a sense, just like I was for Carol, for all the days she loved me, and she for me. Now I'm like that too. Would it be possible for me to love deeply and fully with all of my heart another woman the way I loved Carol? Yes, I believe so. I'm certain of it. It is highly unlikely, I know, given my age and my aversion to normal social channels, including the media kind, that such love will be reciprocated. But should that happen, it will not come at the expense of my love for Carol. She will always be there too, a welcoming presence, just as I came to feel Carol's first husband was for me, always approvingly generous. I will not ever stare at any of the images I have of Carol that I am lucky enough to retain, dreams, photos, the mind's eye, through the lens of some stupid cultural cliché of love as a singularity, long enough to fix her face finally in one place. Anyone who can't live with me, with her fluid image in the picture, at least from time to time, warmly welcome, will not live with me at all. Pictures of things, of natural settings without people in them, are, of course, a different matter. The alive things of the world, especially flora, are, in my opinion at least, so fully present to themselves and their environs that their souls can never be stolen by a camera lens. Every time I walk at Woodard Bay, for example, one of my favorite destinations here, as I approach the point that looks out over the water, I think to myself, well, have enough pictures of this spot. No need to bring out the camera again. And then I always do, my breath taken away by the broad sweep of water and land and sky. Every time, the same spot. Yet so different, like I never saw it before, or need to see it deeply in this particular unique iteration. And I take a picture, or several, same spot, same space in front of me, same deep love animating my view of it. Always moving, just like Carol will be. Except that Woodard Bay is still here, present, in such a dramatic way that taking a picture of it every day for the rest of my life will not, cannot, diminish its true beauty. Yes, it's loving eyes that see beauty truly. When the words for it have fled, they find another way. And that is what I learned today by thinking about my picture-perfect summer here. That was the only way I could actually see this world lovingly, keep an inventory of my presence in it. At least until I had some words again, the proper words I mean, not Eastern or Pennsylvania or Pittsburgh or Boyce Park words. Olympia words. Indigenous words that actually said something loving about what I saw. The right words for a place are surprisingly hard to find, I came to understand. I guess it's kind of like uprooting a plant and moving it to a new place, or taking an animal out of its home territory. They can, most often, adapt. But it takes time, a lot of it. For me, it took the whole of summer. Thus, the comma in the title, as in, first came summer, the time it took to learn the dialect of this place, that long, wordless or stuttering stretch I needed to adapt. Next came this, what you were about to read, which would not have been possible, or would have sounded stupid, if I had not waited, taking pictures, until I knew how to say it. Right before I left Pittsburgh, I wrote the preface to a little book called Last Spring, which documented my final months there, dire, grim, scary months, it turned out. It closes this way, the tail end of a commentary on part two of W.H. Auden's In Memory of W.B. Yeats, which contains these famous lines. For poetry makes nothing happen. It survives. A way of happening. A mouth. Here's what I wrote. In a couple of months, I'll be leaving Pitt and Pittsburgh for good, first for Olympia, Washington, to spend the summer months, maybe more, in the vicinity of my daughter, whom I haven't gotten to see much since she moved out there 12 years ago, who, along with my son, has stood by me steadfastly these last 3 years through thick and thin, who actually wants to have me closer by. Bridget and Joe have been constant voices, mouths, lives for me during this awful and awesome time. Sometimes in person, mostly at the other end of a phone line. I love hearing their words. I can tell in an instant in each of their voices how they are doing, feeling, what I might need to say back as a way of happening, doing. They hear and know my voice too, just that way, all of me in it right then, and they know what to say back as a way of happening, doing. They survive and help me to do the same. Beyond this summer, well, I have no clear idea about exactly the where I might end up or exactly the what I might decide to do with my remaining time and remaining energy. Maybe I'll just eat, sleep, and walk. Maybe I'll fall in love with someone who will fall in love with me. Maybe I'll find a friend who likes to watch baseball games and drink tea. Maybe I'll build rabbit hutches or carve birds. Maybe I'll do some good for some people who need someone to do some good for them. Whatever it turns out to be, I hope I won't write about it. Or, if I do, unable to shake this lifelong habit, I hope it will be different, funny, strange, adorned with little painted figures maybe, hand-printed and stamped on single sheets of parchment, each numbered, then corked inside many bottles, all dropped from a small boat into Puget Sound, so that 100 years from now, someone, in China, say, might find one and wonder. Not something specific, just wonder. Yes, that's it. Just wonder. What I have here, you will find, is not funny or adorned with little painted figures or hand-printed. It may be strange, but it still looks and sounds a lot like what I made back there. And that guy in China, well, he won't be finding it in separate installments, washed ashore in bottles. They will end up on my website and for sale at cost on Amazon. Once I decided to self-publish my books that way, in the desperate aftermath of Carol's sudden passing a few years ago, needing the work out there now, right now, not years down the line after scads of reviewers passed judgments on it, I knew I would not find a wide readership for them, and I haven't. I think they're wonderful books, the best things I've written in my life, and I've written and published a lot via the conventional press. But they did find readers. Loving, generous readers, real, individual people I have gotten to know and love via their interactions with my work, more than ample recompense for the broader public invisibility. I hope this missive will do likewise. Surprisingly, even to me, the one thing I actually wrote a lot this summer was songs, lots of them. My new passion, songwriting, making recordings, putting my work up, like I'm 20-something, on Bandcamp and SoundCloud, where, not surprisingly, I also find a micro-audience. Deservedly so, you might say, if you ever heard me sing and play the guitar. I am amateurish at both. There are a certain few, many fewer than with my books, a certain special few, the ones I believe with ears to hear, who love my music as much as I do. And I do truly love it. I have more than enough digits on my right hand to count them. Maybe that's why I do it. The equivalent of putting printed sheets in a bottle and setting them adrift in the ocean, I suppose. That guy in China? Maybe. Chance in a million. He'll be walking on a beach one day looking for bottles, and his 100 years from now, super Bluetooth earbuds will, by happenstance, tune in to one of my songs, still stuck in the stratosphere. And he'll wonder. I like those odds. I did have one quite pleasing response to my music, a short, moderately positive review on an indie music review website of the first full-length album I put out there, my Olympia Summer Songs, called The Kiss, which I write about in more detail in the final essay. I did a follow-up interview for the site, and I'll quote here what I think is the most crucial thing to know about why I sing and write songs now. The final question the interviewer asked me was this: what else should we know about your music? Here's my response. As I often say when asked, if you want to know me, really, the way I am now, having been through what I've been through, trying my best to keep on, then listen to my songs. If you like what you hear, then you get me. It's possible to do the same thing through the other kinds of writing I do, poetry, personal essays, even my scholarship. But here's what I think about that. I'm a very good writer, spent my life honing those abilities to quite a fine edge. So you might admire my skill, but still not be moved in any way. Allow me to connect with you. I'm not a good singer or guitar player. If you are moved by my music, it's because you hear me, what's in there, trying to get out what I feel and want to share. You are open to it, to me. Your great gift to me. Simple as that. That may not be the best way to preface a book I am hoping to get you to read, but it does imply, at least, that I'm a good writer. Maybe that will be enough to get you to the next page, I mean. If you end up liking what you find here, allow me to move you, connect with you. Maybe you'll keep going until it's done. And then think, maybe I'll listen to one of his songs. And maybe, chance in a million, you'll like that too. I like those odds.